My guest today on Takes on the World, Alan Hart, is a former Middle East chief correspondent for Britain's Independent Television News and a former presenter on BBC's Panorama, specializing in the Middle East. He is the author of several books, including a 1984 biography of Yasser Arafat, Terrorism or Freedom Fighters, Yasser Arafat and the PLO, and in 2007, and the most relevant today, the trilogy Zionism, The Real Enemy of the Jews, which contains not only important details and firsthand history of the Israel-Palestine conflict, but how that conflict has shaped the politics and policies of the United States. I spoke with Alan back on May 8th when we experienced some problems with the phone line, and we ended our conversation with so much more to discuss about the issue and the prospects for the future, so I decided to ask him back again. Welcome, once again, Alan Hart, who Takes on the World.
Great to be back with you, Jeff.
Last night in an email exchange we had, you expressed some thoughts about how the current U.S. NSA surveillance scandal ties into U.S. policy in the Middle East from a perspective that we haven't heard much of. Perhaps you could fill in our audience about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'd like to make just a general couple of comments. I mean, I call it the PRISM affair, okay? Now, it's no substitute for the only effective way to contain and eventually defeat violent Islamic fundamentalism and the terrorism it produces. Question, what is the effective way? Jeff, there are two keys to understanding, in my view. The first is that the vast majority of the world's 1.5 billion Muslims don't want to be enemies of America. Now, it's true that the past years have seen a rising tide of Muslim anti-Americanism, but that takes us to the second key. It is American foreign policy, in particular the drone attacks and unconditional support for the Zionist state of Israel and its crimes, that has been and is the best recruiting sergeant for violent Islamic fundamentalism. So the best way to best protect America's security interests and other interests is to change policy.
Well, this doesn't seem very likely, although when we see in Washington, despite the fact that all the fundamental Islamists or jihadists, they're called by a number of different names, who have no interest in Syria have co-opted and taken over what was a legitimate, non-violent protest movement calling for reform in Syria, and has marginalized those who went into the streets peacefully. And all the reports now, even the mainstream press has to acknowledge that the majority of fighting and actually internecine fighting going on among the opposition is with these foreign fighters. But in Washington, you have the same Israeli lobbyist, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, whose experts get quoted every day in the New York Times. They can't have an article on Syria or Iran, for that matter, without quoting someone from WINEP, which was started by AIPAC back in 1985. There is pressure on Obama, who obviously or apparently seems unwilling to get involved, using jets in Jordan that the U.S. has in Jordan to set up a no-fly zone, or even to follow Israel's example and launch airstrikes on Syrian targets, which would get us into another war. And that would put us again on the side or the wrong side of history. How do you look at that?
Well, Jeff, about Syria, I mean, it seems pretty clear now that Assad's military forces, with the assistance of Hezbollah and the Lebanon, with the backing of Iran, are proving too strong for the divided rebels. I think it would be madness to arm these divided rebels, but there is something, in my view, something very important that Obama could do. The best thing he can do is to get serious about serious negotiations with Iran, on the basis of lifting sanctions in exchange for total inspection of all their nuclear facilities. If he did that, Iran is not developing a nuclear weapon. I mean, most real people know that. But if those two things happened and America was willing to deal with Iran on a basis of mutual respect, so-called, a good relationship, or at least a good working relationship with Iran, would go quite a long way to easing all the nasty things that are happening in the region now.
Well, of course, you see, as I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, on the day of my last broadcast, and that the Senate passed by a 99-0 vote a resolution which calls for the U.S. to come to the military aid of Israel should Israel make the decision to attack Iran, that on both parties, Israel or the Israel lobby has total control, and Obama seems very, very hesitant to take any kind of step that would in which he would have no backing. There's absolutely not a single U.S. senator, even Bernie Sanders, who speak in behalf of lowering sanctions on Iran for any reason.
Yeah, well, I totally believe that Obama, I've gone off Obama, I have to tell you. I find listening to him now as difficult as it was listening to Tony Blair. I want to kick the bloody television set in, quite frankly. But I think he is totally opposed to military action against Iran. The problem is, because he's a prisoner of the Zionist lobby and its various allies, is he going to be pushed against his will into doing it? I don't know.
Well, it's something that makes for what the Chinese call interesting times, a curse of interesting times. What, of course, is the major issue that has at the bottom of all these issues was begun in 1948 when the Israelis ethnically cleansed Palestine of its inhabitants, and again in 1967 when they continued the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, destroying a number of Palestinian villages right off the bat, and 200,000 Palestinians more became refugees, and mostly in Jordan. You have been covering this. You're actually you've got an epiphany afterward, but you were with the Israeli army when it crossed into the Suez in 1967, when you were a young journalist, and then you met with Golda Meir, who you talked about in your interview on the last program, a very frightening interview it was. Do you see any light at the end of a tunnel, or is there even a tunnel when it comes to this issue at this point?
I think you put your finger on it, Jeff. I don't even see a tunnel. But just going quickly back to 1967, yes, I was the first correspondent, Western correspondent of the banks of the Suez Canal with the advance of the Israelis. But what was unique about my experience is that my gut was telling me that war was coming, and ITN allowed me to go 3 weeks, so I reported on the countdown. And I was the only, there were about 700 reporters there, and I was the only one who worked out Diane's deception plan. Now, there was virtually a military coup in Israel without a shot being fired in the few days before that war started. And Prime Minister Eshkol, who didn't want war, nor did Chief of Staff Rabin, were forced to accept Dayan as defense minister. And he put a brilliant deception plan into operation. As soon as he got the job, he called back from the front lines thousands of Israeli soldiers. And he had them on the beach in Tel Aviv and the places in Jerusalem. And that fooled all foreign correspondents. They said, no danger of war, it's past, there's time. They all filed their stories, Jeff, and they all checked out. Now, I didn't. And on the war was on the Monday morning. On the Saturday night, I took a midnight walk through one of the poshest residential squares in Tel Aviv, and I write this in my book, but I saw military buses parked without lights in the side streets, and on the stroke of midnight, little chinks of light appeared as doors opened, and the soldiers who'd been called back from the front got into the buses and went back to the front. It was a brilliant deception plan.
And listeners are probably hearing that for the very first time.
Well, I tell you, Jeff, well, I shall go to my grave. I don't know if I mentioned this before. I was denied by fate the scoop of a reporter's lifetime on the Sunday evening before the Monday war. I filed a 40-second voice piece to ITN saying, for some reasons I can tell you, for others I can't, I think the war will start tomorrow morning. Now, the censor let me say that. ITN were going to run it, but unfortunately, two planes crashed, one in Europe and one in the British Midlands. And ITN Sunday Evening Bulletin was only 7 minutes long, so my speculation was dropped because of all the footage of the bodies and the wreckage and everything else. Now, the point is, had my report have gone out, the Egyptian High Command might have been alerted. They might not have been taken so easily, and Israel might not have had the time to smash the Egyptian army and take the West Bank and the Golan Heights. I shall go to my grave wondering about that.
Well, that there were so many interesting aspects about that war when it turns out, of course, that even though the Israelis had been talking about the Egyptians threatening a whole total holocaust and so on.
Oh, they set a trap for Egypt.
Go on.
In the months before, if you recall, they had some of their aircraft over Syria doing a little bit of shooting up and shooting down Syrian planes. Now, at that time, Nasser and Syria were together in alliance. So Nasser felt compelled to make some deployments. So he put forces into Sinai. And that gave Israel the excuse they needed. I mean, Israel's first claim was that the Arabs attacked, which is absolute nonsense. Its second claim was that the Arabs were going to attack. That was also nonsense. And I tell you what, on the second day of the war, just before I went into Sinai, my mentor in Israel was retired General Chaim Herzog. He was the founder of the Directorate of Military Intelligence. He was at the time in private business, but he went on to become the Secretary General of the Labour Party and then President. On the second day of the war, he said to me, quote, if Nasser hadn't been stupid enough to give us the pretext to smash him, we'd have created one in a year to 18 months, unquote.
It's not surprising. And one aspect which I recall, and only recall because I remember reading it in the papers back in the time, is that not only was the Six-Day War a major military triumph in terms of destroying enemy armies and gaining Lebensraum, more land.
Finishing the business of 48.
Pardon?
Finishing the business of 48.
Well, in 67, there was an article in the papers that I read which pointed out that the Israeli economy was stagnant, that more Israelis were leaving Israel for the United States and other countries than were arriving, and it was like a ship dead in the water. Although American Jews, the majority of American Jews and Jews around the world had supported the birth of Israel, it wasn't uppermost in their minds. They didn't intend to go there or visit there. And suddenly along comes this tremendous victory and the triumphalism in the Jewish community, which I saw in North Hollywood in Los Angeles. I was not much interested in the issue. However, was almost to the point, I'd use the word obscene, you'd think the people in North Hollywood and Beverly Hills had done the fighting. And that turned the whole tide of the majority of American Jews around to support Israel and the proliferation of Jewish organizations and money going to Israel has never ceased.
No, but Jeff, you're absolutely right. But let me just add something.
Sure.
I agree with what you said.
Yeah.
I mean, prior to that war, Ben-Gurion was so pissed off, excuse my English, that enough Jews weren't coming to Israel or interested in it. That what the war did, it was less the victory. Yes, the victory gave Jews everywhere pride, but it was the constant Israeli message that we are about to be attacked, we are about to be annihilated.
That's right.
Actually was the beginning of the re-engagement of the Jews of the world in particular.
Well, they were redoing the Book of Esther.
Yes.
In which the story was that the Persians were going to slaughter the Jews, and so in Persia, if the story goes, and so Esther went to the king, the Persian king, and it turned around the Persians were slaughtered by the Jews in Persia, and there's a holiday celebrating that slaughter called Purim, which is an amazing to me, because to have a holiday celebrating a slaughter of another people seems to be a bit obscene. If those out there celebrate Purim object to that, that's too bad.
But Jeff, you know the tragedy today is that most of the Jews of the world simply do not want to know the truth. And I tell a story in my book. My second best friend in the world, after my dear wife, is my... We've been best friends for 40 years. He's traveled to various countries with me. He's not personally all that keen on what's happening in Israel. But just before I published the English edition of my book, Zionism, the Real Enemy of the Jews, I said to him, you believe, like most Jews, that in 1967 Israel went to war either because the Arabs attacked first or were intending to attack. And I said to him, if I can prove to you, using only Israeli sources, that that's a complete load of nonsense, what? And he paused, and after about a minute he said, if what I believe about that war is not true, everything crumbles. Now, dear Anna Boltzer, you know Anna Boltzer, of course.
Yes, yes.
She said to me she thought that was the single most powerful story in the book. They don't want to know the truth, Jeff.
It's like people, let's say, who believed in Stalin, for example, and didn't want to know the truth of what was going on in Soviet Russia.
Well, you see, I have a way of putting it. I think the Jews, most of them, need victimhood. If you take victimhood away from them, who are they? What are they?
Well, this is it's after what we hear are centuries of persecution. This idea of being the eternal victim, even when you have your foot on the other person's neck, as is the case in Palestine, you're still the victim. And you hear constantly, of course, that Israel's surrounded by enemies, has the sixth largest military in the world, maybe 200, 400 atomic weapons, and Israel is still the victim. And it is incredible, and people are getting tired of it. Unfortunately, in the United States, politically, the Jewish establishment, which represents a minority of Jews, but a very powerful minority, it seems to dictate policies in the Middle East for Washington.
You know, Jeff, a few nights ago, I was watching television, and I nearly had to puke. I was watching Al Jazeera, and David Frost was interviewing Shimon Peres.
Oh.
And I awarded Peres, in my mind, a prize for the most obscenely ridiculous statement ever made on this conflict by anybody. He said the Palestinians are suffering from self-victimization. Can you believe it?
That's a projection of award-winning quality.
Yeah.
No, this is it. But he's not the only one who said this. Peres, of course, is the father of the Israeli atomic bomb. And
he is one of them, certainly.
He's shepherded through. He wasn't alone in that. But it is amazing to hear statements like that. You know, one of the things that my guest, by the way, is Alan Hart, a British journalist who with long experience in the Middle East covering that war, and author of Zionism, the Real Enemy of the Jews, and a few of the world, I would say. It's actually very scary, as you mentioned, the so-called Samson option, the victimization, idea of victimization carried to the point where Golda Meir, but other Israelis have said, if we are going to go, and if they believe they're going to go, not necessarily they would be destroyed, that they would take the rest of the world with them, and that's a frightening prospect.
Yeah, well, Golda said that to me live on a BBC Panorama interview.
I know you mentioned that. It was one of the powerful moments of our interview a few weeks ago. One of the things that people don't know very much about, and one of the things that has kept the problem festering in the Middle East, is Resolution 242, which was a resolution drawn up in the United Nations territories. But in fact, the American ambassador Arthur Goldberg, a close friend of President Johnson, who was the architect of, or the, who was involved in writing 242 from the American side, was very influential in how that was written and how it's been interpreted. Perhaps you could talk about that.
Yeah, well, the real problem with 242 is it did call on Israel to get out of occupied territories, but in the original draft, and I was told this by the British ambassador at the time, whose name I have temporarily forgotten, but I was told the inside story by him, the original draft required Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories, the definitive article the. Now, you know, in anybody's language, that equates to withdraw from all, right?
Yes.
And what Goldberg did, whether he did it off his own back or whether he had others colluding with him, they insisted on taking the word the out. So Israel was required to withdraw from occupied territories. Now, what that did, Jeff, it left Zionism in the driving seat. It was up then to Zionism to decide how much land it would withdraw from. So effectively, what 242 did was to create two sets of rules for the behavior of nations, one for all the nations of the world minus Israel, and one for Israel. And that was the formal birth of what is today called the double standard. Incidentally, I discovered today, perhaps you knew about it long before I did, that in September 1975, President Ford wrote a secret letter to Prime Minister Rabin, which actually said whatever initiatives the US might propose, it would take care not to propose anything that was unacceptable to Israel. Can you believe it?
Well, that's interesting. I'm not sure when he made that, because I know in 1975...
First of September.
Okay. Before that's interesting. Before that, he and actually Kissinger had become so frustrated with trying to get Israel to withdraw, disengage from areas in the Sinai. It had taken the 1973 war.
Yeah, Kissinger set that up with Sadat. That was a joint, because Kissinger was fed up with Israel.
Right, but Rabin would not withdraw, and Ford let it be known that he was going to make a major speech calling for a reassessment of U.S.-Israel relations. And within 3 weeks, AIPAC got the signatures of 76 U.S. senators across the aisle. They got them on individually, buttonholed them, got 76 senators to sign a very strong letter to President Ford, warning him not to do anything to interfere with U.S.-Israel relations. Ford backed down, did not give the speech, and what you just explained to us...
Yes, you've just explained the background as to why on the 1st of September 9th he wrote this bloody letter.
And he recognized, and other presidents have recognized, that there was one power in Washington that you do not cross publicly. This is what George Bush challenged the Israel lobby, in the first George Bush, in 1991, when he would not allow Israel's request for $10 billion in loan guarantees to go forward, and he paid for that by losing the re-election to Bill Clinton.
Absolutely. But you know, it's not only the Zionist lobby and its allies that American presidents are prisoners of and frightened of. I might have mentioned the last time we spoke, there is another reason. American presidents are terrified of what Israel might do.
Israeli weapons targeting major friendly capitals, or at least unfriendly friendly capitals with this nuclear weapons edit, and getting back to Moshe Dayan, he talked about Israel profits when it's known as a mad dog that could do anything, like a loose cannon. So they're very worried about what Israel might do.
Well, Jeff, I once asked Dayan, I think it was in 1969. I mean, I knew him quite well. And I once asked him in his house why Israel had nuclear weapons. Did I tell you this story?
Go ahead, tell us.
I said to him, look, we both know you don't need nuclear weapons vis-a-vis the Arabs. You can beat them any day of the week with both hands tied behind your back. Why have you got nuclear weapons? And he said, Ben-Gurion was not stupid. I'm not stupid. We assumed from day one of the creation of our state that a day would come when even our best friends would turn against us. And what he said by obvious implication is, we have the weapons to say to them, Mr. President or whoever, don't push us too far or we'll use these things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Diane actually said. It's a blackmail card.
It's blackmail. It's scary. I wanted to talk about something that's been buried. We hear all this talk about what happened in Benghazi and the call for an investigation of the death of four Americans, including an ambassador of Benghazi. But on June 8, 1967, the Israeli Air Force and Navy, for a couple of hours, attacked a U.S. ship, well-marked, well-identified U.S. intelligence ship, in international waters off the coast of Egypt, the USS Liberty, and killed 34 sailors and wounded 171. Perhaps you could talk about the implications of that.
Yeah, but you know why. I mean, the order for the attack was, the Israelis claimed it was an accident, which is nonsense. The attack took place over several hours in the most brilliant daylight, and they knew what they were doing. Diane ordered it. The story is, why did he order it? The Liberty was there because America's generals and top political people did not trust Israel to keep its word. Johnson had given them the green light in 67 to attack Egypt and destroy the Egyptian forces. But only Egypt, he effectively said to them, don't even think about taking the West Bank and even more the Syrian Golan Heights. Because Johnson feared that the Russians, the Soviet Union as it was, could live with the defeat of Nasser, but they might not be able to live with the defeat of Nasser and Syria. So the Liberty was there, Jeff, listening to Israeli military communication, that Israel had only 3 or 4 days for the war before the whistle would be blown in the Security Council. So Israel had to put everything, almost everything it had, into the Sinai to guarantee to smash Egypt totally, you know, in quick time. But then, because Diane was determined to take the West Bank and the Golan Heights, he had to turn around a large part of the military force in the Sinai. Now, I saw it happening, though I didn't realize its significance at the time. I saw tanks being loaded onto large lorries to be taken to the West Bank and further on to the Golan. Now, the point was, the orders for that turnaround had to come by radio from Diane's Ministry of Defense in Tel Aviv. And that's what the Liberty was there to listen to. And the idea was that if the Israelis broke their word, the message would be flashed to Johnson, get on the hotline to Eshkol and tell him to stop. The Liberty was taken out to make Johnson blind and not know what was going on until it was too late. Now, the lesson of the attack on the Liberty, and I conclude my whole chapter on the Liberty of my book with this thought, that what it proves is that there is nothing Israel won't do to its friends as well as its enemies to get its own way.
And what it also sends to Israel is that they can kill Americans with impunity. Even the young American, Turkish American on the Mavi Marmara was called a Turk, even though he was an American. And
yeah, well, Johnson did a complete cover-up, of course.
Well, Johnson, of course, and the sailors, were those who survived were warned that should they talk about this attack, that they would be subject to court-martial. And it wasn't until one of the lieutenants, Anas, wrote a book some years later about it. But it's interesting, there's never been a congressional investigation of the USS Liberty, and that, as I mentioned earlier, before I called you, Admiral John McCain, the father of the Senator John McCain, was orchestrated a flimsy investigation in which even the Israeli pilots who carried out the attacks were not to be questioned. It's a pretty horrible situation.
One of my happiest memories, yes, a couple of years ago, I was the guest speaker at the Liberty Survivors annual dinner in Long Island, and I shall treasure that memory. But my worry today, I mean, I have two driving motivations. One is to contribute to the understanding needed for justice for the Palestinians. The other is to contribute to the understanding needed to stop Holocaust II, another great turning against the Jews. And my fear is that the rising tide of anti-Israelism now could be transformed into anti-Semitism. And in my view, it could start in America.
Alan, thank you very much for being our guest again today. Another enlightening interview, and great talking to you. And
my pleasure.
I look forward to doing it again.
Goodbye to your listeners, Jeff.